okay. If I could have your attention. Thank you. That was pretty easy. Didn't know I had such power. I'm going to call to order the banquet of the Spring 2007 Convention of the California Council of the Blind. Eventually, we're going to be streaming out to ACB Radio Land, so everybody be on their best behavior.
You'll be sorry.
Okay. We're going to begin with the invocation this evening with Pastor Audrey Ward from the Central United Methodist Church. If I could have your attention, order.
Quiet.
Pastor Ward.
We got to pray.
Thank you. A great poet, some of you might know, T.S. Eliot in the Four Quartets, wrote, "But the faith and the love and the hope are all in the waiting. Wait without thought. And so the darkness shall be the light and the stillness the dancing." Shall we pray? Oh, love. Dance through us tonight by your presence amongst us at these tables and nourish us not just with the food but with each other's presence and your presence most of all. We thank you for this time of community, of making connections, and of being connected to something so much more vast, so much greater than any organization can be, when we are connected through your spirit in power and in love. So may this evening be a blessing to each person here, and may each one be strengthened by the food, by the presence at the table, and by the love that empowers us all day by day. Hallelujah. Amen.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you, Pastor Ward. Okay, now I only have a small chore to do, which is good as far as I'm concerned. I'm going to introduce the MC to you. Now, I make it a practice to learn. I try to learn a little bit about every MC that I introduce.
And
it takes a little doing, but I've done it in the past. I'm going to continue to do it as long as I'm officiating up here.
Well, you better be careful.
And I did learn a couple things about Catherine Skivers. But just two. She was, back when she still lived in Missouri, she was about 18, she was wild and blonde. I mean, she had many, many young suitors calling. And one evening, around 1 o'clock, perhaps 2, she was probably whispering sweet nothings to one of them. When the phone rang,
I've never whispered in my life.
And she picked it up and she said, "Oh, no, no, that's many, many miles from here," and hung up. And the suitor said, "Well, gee, what was that all about?" "Oh," she said, "the person just wanted to know whether the coast was clear." But later on, Kathy did get serious, and she went to, she came out to California, and before she went to OCB and got into all the blind movement, she went to engineering school, and she actually, applied for a job as an engineer, and she took this test, and there were two applicants, and they both got the same score. They got 9 out of 10. But the prospective employer came up to her and said, "Well, I'm sorry, Ms. Skivers, but I have to give it to the other applicant." And she said, "Well, why? What did I do? You know, were you discriminating against me because I was blind?" He said, "No, not at all." He said, "You both missed the same question. His answer to it was, I don't know, and yours was, neither do I. Anyway, we all know that Kathy Skivers is the heart and soul of this organization. So many of us have been mentored by her. She will give the shirt off her back to help a blind person in need, and there's really not much more to say about the true spirit of this organization. Our MC for this evening, Kathy Skivers.
Just before I introduce the head table, hey, I haven't been gone so long that you guys know when I start, you're supposed to stop. Anyway, one correction, Mr. Tom. At 18, I was not running around. I'd been married for 2 years, and I behaved myself.
So you say.
And you weren't whispering either.
Oh, I'm going to love our speaker tonight. I already did. He said I wasn't whispering either. And you just met me. All right, ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to be your MC this evening. We have a wonderful program that I'll tell you more about later. But I want to introduce some people to you now. And I want to say that I didn't know that we were going to be taking advantage of blind people tonight. First, the bar wasn't where it should have been. And now my head table list that has been given me, they have moved people around. So if I give your name and it's not you, will you please say it's not me? I'll be less embarrassed that way. To my left is a gentleman named Paul Patchy. And you've got to watch out for him. I went and met him last evening, shook hands. He said how nice it was to get to meet me and sold me some tickets. Next to him is Joni Patchy, chair of the... Joni is chair of the Blind Advisory, the community group, and she does a great job. Leslie Tom, the first lady of CCB, is next. And a man who doesn't always get his story straight, but most of the time he does, our president, Jeff Tom. And then somebody that I think is very special, she took a lighthouse and made it shine, and that's the executive director, Anita Aaron. And then we have our speaker, and I know they always say the speaker, you'll hear him later, but I think you're going to hear him a lot, and I'm so happy we have him. Our speaker is going to be, and you'll hear more later, but it's Mike Hinkson. And the next one sitting here is me. And to my right is Chris Gray, president of the American Council of Blind and our treasurer.
Oh, God, he mixes money with politics.
And Marvelina Quesada is the first lady of ACB, and we're both in green. How do you like that? And next is a gentleman that I hope to get to meet, Bob Seliger, all the way from Iowa. No, that's wrong. Correction. It's Bob, all right, but it's our good friend we heard from today and our fighting lawyer, Bob Humphreys.
Yeah. I don't know who is where.
Everybody know who's in where.
Yeah.
Thank you, Donna.
Donna Seliger, secretary of the American Council of Blind, and soon to be on there again, because this is her ending term, but we can't let her go. And Donna Seliger from Iowa, American Council. Yeah. Now I believe.
I think
it's Bob Seliger.
Yeah.
Who is?
I hope.
Ed. I'm not seeing well. I left off with Donna Seliger. This gentleman is from the U.S. Access Board, and I've got to apologize to him, Scott Wimbley, because, you know, you've come to a place where vision isn't the great thing, and we're happy to have you. And next is someone I know and have known a long time, our first vice president, second vice president. I'm trying to make promotions. Eugene Lozano Jr. And all the way there at the end, I sure don't want to mix up things with this lady. She's so good to come to us and pray for us tonight is Pastor Audrey Ward of the Central Methodist Church. And thank you so much for being with us. I'm sure that you're a lot more interested in salad than hearing how many more mistakes I can make. Are we being streamed at the present time?
Yes, we are.
Oh, I have something from the speaker. He says I don't have to worry about watching what I say because I can't see anyway. I think what we're going to do is get into our salads, have some dinner, and I'll come back and see what else I can mix up, and we'll be here very soon. Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please, for just a minute? Ladies and gentlemen, can I have your attention for 2 minutes?
No.
It's going up. Your attention are for 5 minutes. You're getting the message. Good, good, good. There are a few people here that I want to introduce, and they're not at the head table, but they're people that we need to recognize and know and think about and welcome. And the lady from Seattle has been doing, she has a radio program of her own. We all know who she is. And she is doing our streaming, and she's going to have the distinction of showing people in this world what California does when Kathy's here. Anyway, Marlena Lieberg. I don't want to thank you. And I would also like to acknowledge two people who do yeoman work for us every year and have for years. Mary Lou and Pinky are Christian volunteers. And we wouldn't do what we do the way what we do it without our staff, Marilyn Kohler and Ed Branch. I scared me. I wasn't sure I remembered his last name. We've only worked together for yay many years. I don't know how many. I don't know if you'd like to move on with the program or now or not. But first, I don't like stories that are told at banquets. The only people that really told me a lot of stories included George Fogarty, and he's no longer with us, and neither is Alan Jenkins. If I could remember George's, I could tell them to you. But Alan Jenkins, with his limericks, I wouldn't dare if I could remember them. But in any case, I have a story I'm going to tell you because it's expected of MCs. So I'll do it now so you can get the pain over. I do this kind of stuff once in a while. I may have told you this story before, and if I did, please be patient, because I like it so much I'm going to tell it again. It seems there were two of these elderly people, an elderly couple came before a judge, and the lady came forward, the older lady, and she was charged with stealing.
Thank you.
And the judge said, well, what exactly did you steal? She said, I stole some peaches, a can of peaches. He said, well, why did you do it? She said, well, because I was hungry. And he said, how many peaches were there? She said, there were six. And he said, all right. He said, I'm going to give you 6 days in jail for that. And the elderly gentleman, who happened to be her husband, held up his hand and he said, "Could I say something, Judge?" And he said, "Yes, what is it?" He said, "She stole a can of peas, too." We have in the crowd someone that I don't know. I guess he's going to remain anonymous. But he likes to take chances, I guess. He sent me a martini up here, and I deliberately didn't have any before I got here, so I would be good, well, at least somewhat passable. And here I have this. Anyway, thank you, whoever you are. And if we get to a point in this connection here when you shouldn't have done it, then you'll hear it. Okay, I also want to acknowledge Anita's husband who's with us, Bob Aaron. We never get around to welcoming him. Welcome, Bob. And we don't have him up here because we don't like him. We just didn't know he was coming till later on. We have a practice in this organization of recognizing people. And we had, at a time, we had people come forward when our chapters gave us some much-needed contributions. And we thought it was cool for them to come up here and give their names of their organization and what they were giving. And somebody decided that in the interest of time, we shouldn't do that. Well, you know what? We've got more time than money. And and I'm so happy to tell you that we have reinstated that. So those of you who have made contributions, chapters to this organization this spring, please start making your way forward. We want you to announce who you are and what you gave us and who you gave it to.
My name is Elizabeth Klein. I'm the treasurer of the San Francisco chapter of the California Council of the Blind. And I think in our chapter we gave about $200 or $300 to the scholarship fund. So hopefully that...
Roy Harmon from Oceanside, California, from the Randolph Shepherd Vendors of California, present you with a check for $200. Yeah, thank you.
This is Pam Pology from the San Gabriel Valley chapter. And our chapter would like to present a check for $250 to the general fund. Thanks, you guys. God bless.
This is Abby Schumann, the loudmouth of the greater L.A. chapter. We're giving $100 to scholarship fund, $100 to general fund. Now I'm putting on another hat. The Lily Perry Foundation is giving $10,000 to the scholarship fund.
David Jackson from OCB Alumni Association, $70 to the scholarship fund.
We have $300 from the Bayview chapter. And Ed is going to read others that we have on the list when no one else is coming forward.
Ed. We have the Greater Los Angeles chapter gave $100 to the CCV General Fund and $100 to the Scholarship Fund.
Just said that.
Okay. I guess that was it.
Did you all enjoy your dinner? So did I, but I have planned to write a recommended menu for dinners. I think...
Oh, no, Liz, no.
What? What I think we should do... Let me have your attention, please. I think a salad would be great if all the lettuce was piled on one side and all the good stuff was piled on the other side. Gravy, I wouldn't have because I usually end up wearing it. And I do think that the best thing of any banquet is when we all can get together like this. I want to thank you all for the contributions you make to this council. It's our business in this organization to recognize people for what they do. We give you, the members, the opportunity to nominate people for awards who you feel are deserving of recognition. I am awards and history chair. Jeff combined them. Serving on my committee are Roger Peterson, Bernice Kandarian, Gussie Morgan, Joe Smith, Chris Gray, Don Queen, and I. And Al Gill. Now, this is what happened. I thought there was only so much of myself you all would be able to stand, so I decided to ask some of the other people to help make awards. Well, that was fine, till Al told me he wouldn't be here. He was going to a family thing. And Don Queen didn't come up. And one or two other things happened, so here's how it's going to go. We're going to have some introductions. We're going to have, we're going to have publications awards, and then we're going to have Chris Gray make three awards. Roger Peterson's going to make one. And whether you've had too much of me or not, I'm going to make some.
All right.
So, Bernice... Oh, and may I didn't recognize two other people. I should have. The way to do it when you're going someplace and you want to be escorted is to have your children bring you. Then they, you know, you don't have a problem. Oh. And I'm so happy to have Eric and Daryl Skivers here.
Yeah!
Long ago, they got awards at different times for their volunteerism and. One evening, I knew one of them was going to get one, but I couldn't tell them, and I said, you have to sit at the head table. I don't want to. I said, well, you have to sit there. Well, you know, that's the only time they came to sit at the head table, and they did not dress up, and that's the only time they never dressed up for the banquet. And then when they got, one of them got the award, they both yelled at me. I never did figure that out. Anyway, I bring this up now because Eric will be reading our plaques for us. And we hope we connect the names with everything. First of all, we're going to begin with, before we do the publications, we have recognition of our chapters. We have an award. Okay. We have two chairs on that committee, two chairpersons. We have Rhonda King and Artis Bazin. And Artis is going to be here this evening to make a presentation of award for membership, and she's going to tell you all about it. Artis?
Okay, hello everyone. It's my pleasure to tell you who the winner of the Membership Incentive Award is. This award is given every spring to the chapter who has increased their membership from the previous year for the largest percentage. And this year, the award will go to BRLC, who increased their membership from 29 to 47. Hey, this means that chapter will receive $100, and I encourage all of you chapters to work for that next year. And, of course, in the fall, we have the Membership Incentive Award for chapters who increase their membership the most between spring and fall. So you have another several months to try for that. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Artis. The person who now is the president of BRLC is Marlene O'Neill, secretary of the Bayview chapter. She's a secretary there, and she's now president of BRLC. She kicked off her first meeting yesterday, and we thought she did great. Ladies and gentlemen, there's nothing worse than some MC or chairperson that keeps saying, quiet, stop talking, order please. And you don't dare say shut up, especially when you're on worldwide TV or whatever, we're on air radio. And I tell you what, I think I'm going to recommend to the president that you start having a quiz. At the beginning of each banquet, you should have a quiz on what happened at the last banquet, and anybody that can't answer it should pay a fine into our treasury. What do you think of that idea? When you have a committee like this one, you really are fortunate. Roger did a tremendous job, Roger Peterson, for this committee for such a long time. He wanted to give it up, but he didn't know that the president was going to appoint the dinosaur of computer users who doesn't use one. And so he's still doing a lot of the work. But today, because he's such a good kid, when we get around to it, he'll only be doing one award. But I want to say about Roger Peterson that someday, even when I'm not awards chairman anymore, I'm going to write some kind of an award I think he should have. That man, we have him in all categories. And if anybody in this organization deserves an award for everything we do because he does it, it's Roger Peterson.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the lady, in spite of serious illness, got better and is able to be here tonight. She is our publications award chair, our award publications chair, and she's going to make two awards. And I hope we're going to get the right names. When she says the first name, Eric, we'll find that plaque. So, Bernice Kandarian, you're on for two awards for your publications.
In 2000, the ACB National Convention was in Louisville, Kentucky, and I was working for Social Security in Los Angeles at the time. I asked my boss for administrative leave to attend the convention, and I had to write a report when I got back. And George Fogarty was the banquet MC that evening. It was too. Oh, I was in 1980, excuse me, in 1980. Oh, I'm dating myself. Anyway, what I learned from George at that banquet was that SSA is ass backwards.
Yeah, and either one of them. Barbara's here, and she's going to take those other chairs.
What did she say? We missed it.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sitting with former Social Security employees here. I knew they'd like that. Okay. You have to bear with me. I've been experiencing a paralyzed vocal cord, and I couldn't talk at all there for a while. But I'm doing much better, but my voice is still a little weak. And I'm going to have a little technical difficulty here with my type and speak. So, this year's issue oriented article, I want to acknowledge some honorable mentions here. Okay. An honorable mention is A Career Connection, The Interview by Kathy Schmidt-Whitaker, and Tech Talk, The Wireless Craze by Luis Herrera. But this year's recipient is the best issue-oriented article for 2006, Review of Louis Braille, A Touch of Genius by Winifred Downey. I understand that Winifred is not at the banquet this evening, so we'll have to see that she gets her plaque.
Thank you. Okay, I'll go ahead and read what this plaque says, a little bit what it looks like. It's a clear glass type of a background, black plate, silver writing, very pretty. California Council of the Blind Publications Award, Best Issue-Oriented Article of 2006 to Winifred Downing for Review of Louis Braille, A Touch of Genius. The Blind Californian, Spring 2006, presented this 14th day of April 2007 in Sacramento, California, to Winifred.
Congratulations. Okay, for the lifestyle article, honorable mention is to CCB Storms Nation's Capital by Frank Welty, and the other ACB Convention, A First Time Experience by Kurt Weston. And this year's winner of the lifestyle article, best lifestyle article of 2006, Gesundheit, whoever, it goes to Sylvia Lopez, My Unfinished Story. Was I doing that? No. Okay.
This plaque is the same as the other one, if you're looking at it. It reads, California Council of the Blind Publications Award, Best Lifestyle Article of 2006 to Sylvia Lopez for My Unfinished Story, appeared in the Blind Californian, the spring 2006 issue. Congratulations to Sylvia.
Is Sylvia in the room? I wasn't able to locate her. Okay, we'll see that she gets her plaque, too. I want to thank the Publications Committee, acknowledge them. Cecil Betts is one of our members who you've enjoyed her writings in the Blind Californian. And I haven't called her recently, but a couple of months ago she told me that she had cancer, and she's 89, so she was making some hard decisions there. Evelyn Drury, Winifred Downing, Brian Hall, Lewis Preston, Catherine Schmidt Whitaker, Bonnie Rennie, and then Richard Retta, and Dan Kaiser is the webmaster, and Mike Keithley is the editor, and I think I got everybody. Thank you very much.
Okay, now, you know, there's George Fogarty. Those of you who remember George, used to walk up to me after I conducted any kind of a meeting, and when I was president of this group, he walked up and he'd take both hands after the meeting and he'd say, I love to watch you work, Kathy. And I always, you know, I don't know. But anyway, now I'm going to introduce somebody that I love to watch work. He's on our committee. He has lots of jobs. Sometimes he's president of American Council. Sometimes he's our treasurer. Sometimes he's running his own new business. But all the time he's working for us and blind people. And so to do our next three awards, I'm going to ask Chris Gray to take over.
Thank you very much, Kathy, ladies and gentlemen. I'm so pleased to be able to do something fun like give an award this evening. We do a lot of various work in our organizational activities, but recognizing the great work that people do is one of those moments that is just a pure pleasure, and thank you for allowing me to be a part of that tonight. I want to bring the first award to a person who I have known as a tremendous advocate for many, many years. We met in the early 1990s, and it was my pleasure, my honor, to participate with this individual in some very, very significant negotiations with a transit agency in Santa Clara County, and we had some good success. It's been better and worse over the years, but we made a tremendous amount of progress in the mid-1990s in this work. This person has gone on and done much additional work in the area of transportation advocacy, advocacy for accessibility, for technology, and advocacy in the work of signage in accessible formats for Kaiser Hospital, and a person who has been a leading force in advocating for talking pill bottles in California and around the nation. Due to her efforts, the talking pill bottles are now available through Kaiser Permanente facilities, which is a tremendous step forward for blind people. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to introduce to you a person, the winner of a major CCB award this evening. One time, she and Marvelina happened to run across each other in the hallway, and Marvelina's dog was doing, kind of pushing through, as dogs are wont to do, and Marvelina said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I've just got this pushy New York guide dog." And our recipient tonight said, "That's all right, honey. I'm a pushy California advocate today." Ladies and gentlemen, the winner of the Community Service Advocacy Award for the California Council of the Blind, please welcome Barbara Rhodes. Barbara, I'm sure you're here.
Yes, I am.
Pretty darn sure. So why don't you come up and say something.
I'm going to read this.
We'll get
first,
you a mic.
She has to have her plaque read. Then she can say something.
Oh, the plaque. I'm sorry, Eric. Let's hear the plaque
all right.
First.
That's all right. They fixed the mic. That's what matters. Yeah. This is another beautiful plaque here. And it reads as follows. California Council of the Blind Community Service Award to Barbara Rhodes. For years of tireless advocacy for accessibility in areas such as transportation and medical services for blind and visually impaired people, including especially her efforts which resulted in the availability of talking prescription medicine bottles throughout the Kaiser Permanente system in California. This is for you, Barbara. Congratulations.
Thank you. Same as the others. Thank you so very much. I'm speechless. And that's a miracle in itself.
I'm going to write the date down, Barbara.
You write it down because it ain't going to happen again. Now, I am so very, very honored. I did not expect this. And I've got tears in my eyes. Thank you so very much. But while I'm here, let me just show you. Quantity 90 tablets. Take one tablet orally daily. For refills, please call 1-888-218-6245 and choose option 2 for assistance. Anyone who is a member of Kaiser Permanente can have it added to their profile that they can get talking pill bottles at no additional charge. So far, so good. But it is a wonderful service, and unfortunately, my husband has joined our ranks. He is now a member of the visually impaired community, too, and having the talking pill bottles has been a lifesaver for both of us. So I thank you all so very, very much. And I lost my cane. Now I got it. Thank you.
Our next two awardees aren't here. But
Barbara, please know how much we appreciate you. I know that advocates often don't feel appreciated because of the nature of our work. But we certainly do appreciate you.
Well, I thank you so very much. I'm very, very honored. Thank you, everybody.
I now would like to proceed to give two humanitarian awards, and I'm sorry that the people we're awarding are not here tonight, but I would like to present them and give them some time and honor on the program. The first award is to Gregory A. Smith. He's the leading pharmacist in Santa Clara, in the Santa Clara Kaiser facility. He understood the need for talking pill bottles, and he really got it that this would allow blind and visually impaired people to safely and accessibly give themselves the medication they need. Ladies and gentlemen, Gregory A. Smith.
Read the plaque, Eric.
Eric will read the plaque for us now.
I'm going to read it anyway, even though he's not here. It reads, California Council of the Blind Humanitarian Award to Gregory A. Smith, who as lead pharmacist at the Kaiser Permanente Santa Clara Hospital demonstrated extraordinary sensitivity to the needs of patients who are blind and visually impaired, initiating the program to provide them talking prescription medicine bottles in Kaiser facilities throughout the state of California. Awesome. That's for him.
And another humanitarian award is being presented tonight to Kaiser Permanente Incorporated for recognizing the need and providing the means of accessibility to medication.
Fair is fair.
And Eric?
Yes. Humanitarian Award to Kaiser Permanente California Division for its pioneering efforts to provide necessary prescription information to blind and visually impaired patients by making available to them talking prescription medicine bottles in Kaiser facilities throughout the state of California.
As a closing comment, I want you all to know the last two awards are the awards Barbara thought were being given. The first one was a bit of a surprise, and thank you all very much.
Yeah. That, Mr. Chris?
Yes.
Hey, friend. I want to say that making this happen was a joint effort from all members of the California Council of the Blind, but especially for Jeff Tom and Jean Lozano and Dawn Wilcox and a number of Frank Welty, a number of people. We had meetings with Kaiser up in their Oakland office. We really, really worked hard and advocated. And the combination was my having to go over to the new Kaiser facility and meeting Gregory A. Smith, who is a wonderful, wonderful. He even gave me his phone number, his cell phone number, and I called him and said, at Tahoe over the weekend because I wasn't getting information about medications. So, I mean, he is a very, very loving, caring gentleman, and he's my good friend now. And I want to talk to my chapter to see if possibly at our meeting I can have Gregory come up and present the plaque to him, and perhaps his boss could get the plaque. So if that could be arranged, I'll try and do it that way, if that would meet with your approval. But thank you so very, very much, everybody.
Am I open? Thank you so much. You deserve it. Let me give you a little story here about Barbara. I forgot to tell you at the beginning of this evening that the theme of this thing is we're going to talk about people. So I'm going to talk about Barbara. Barbara was recently in the hospital, extremely ill. And she pushed the little button there that you are when a nurse is supposed to come or somebody's supposed to respond. She was there for 25 minutes and nobody came. And she was in dire need of assistance. So guess what our advocate did? Here she is in the hospital and she calls 911. Else, ladies and gentlemen, who else? I asked her if she got help. She said, I sure did. All right. Now I'm going to do some things here. We have two more awards and two Hall of Famers, and I'm going to do them. I want to know, are there any Bayview chapter members in this room?
Yeah.
Are there any East Bay Center members in this room?
Yes.
All right, I'm telling you now, even though this is worldwide, this lady won't be listening. And if any of you tell
there's going to be retribution you won't believe. She's got to be surprised, because what we're going to do, she's a Bayview member. We're going to have it read to you. She's a wonderful person. She volunteers. God knows how many miles she's driven members in the area. She drives blind people anywhere. She's there anytime you need her. She reads, and she says she doesn't do windows, but she does everything else. And she's a fantastic person. And two of our members, I did not nominate her. I would have, but I did tell some. What do you call it when you're not telling the truth? I wouldn't lie on a bet. I told her all kinds of little stories to try to get her up here tonight. She said, oh, I am just too, I can't drive that far. And she said, besides, she hasn't been very good health either. She says, besides, I've got a Saturday off for the first time in about 3 months. I'm staying home. So I think all of you, her father-in-law was in the vending stand business, Joe Johnson. And so the person who's getting this award that Eric will read and we will present at next Saturday's Bayview chapter meeting, Ida Johnson.
Ida's plaque reads, California Council of the Blind Merit Award to Ida Mae Johnson for many years assisting blind and visually impaired individuals and organizations with reading and driving, and serving in many capacities such as a secretary and treasurer of numerous organizations of and for the blind. For Ida.
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
I'm in error. You know, when I don't have things all written down, they say I'm good at winging things, and once one of my wings just almost fell off. We do have another very important award, and Roger Peterson is going to make this award and tell you what it is and what it's about.
Yeah, I'm glad that Barbara got that award, and I'm glad that all the stories were told. I think it was also remarkable. I remember hearing that when she was having a heart attack and she was in the hospital, she was still calling the ADA coordinator and telling him that she didn't get accessible formats.
You know?
Yeah. But anyway, so we give awards to people that really deserve them. And one of perhaps the most prestigious award that we give is our Distinguished Service Award. The rules about it say that it doesn't have to be given every year. It's only given when somebody really deserves it. And it's for continuous, outstanding, prolonged service to the blind community of California. And it can be, it has to be by a visually impaired person. They don't have to be a member of CCB, but, you know, they have to be a good person. Anyway, when I first came to the Bay Area back in 1986, I remember my first dealings with the San Francisco Lighthouse. It was, at that time, as I recall, it was kind of like, it was, it had a lot of services and so forth, but it was kind of not exactly consumer-driven. In fact, I would say it was consumers versus the Lighthouse. And we were, you know, meeting and trying to get rid of the executive director and everything. In the time since then, it has become a very innovative agency, an agency that has that is consumer-friendly, an agency that does a lot of neat things like web by phone and a great store and a great computer lab and all the rest of it. And there's one person who's primarily responsible for that. She's a consumer herself and knows all about nothing about us without us and all that kind of thing. And has been for some time, I think, the executive director of the San Francisco Lighthouse. And now she's putting the weight of the lighthouse and of herself behind getting accessible pedestrian signals all over San Francisco, so you can cross the street without getting run over, maybe. I'm really proud to present the Distinguished Service Award of the California Council of the Blind to Anita Aaron.
This is awesome. All right. right. I want to say that this plaque here is a little different than the other ones. I just wanted everybody to know. It has a completely black background, and the big plate is also black as well, inlaid inside with gold writing. Another, they're all beautiful, but this one says, California Council of the Blind Distinguished Service Award to Anita Aaron for her leadership in directing the San Francisco Lighthouse to become an outstanding, innovative, and consumer-friendly agency serving the blind community, and for her dedicated advocacy in such areas as accessible pedestrian facilities, making the streets and intersections of San Francisco safe for blind and visually impaired pedestrians. That's what it says. For.
You think Barbara Rhodes was speechless? You know, I think there's two events. I've never seen Barbara speechless, and I'm glad I was here to witness that. Wasn't that a great thing? Gee, you guys, this is... When Kathy says she doesn't tell the truth, she actually lies. I don't care what... Kathy called me several weeks ago and said, are you going to be at the banquet this year? And I said, yes. And she said, oh, good, because I just want to make sure I have friends in the audience. So... So, yeah. So I guess it's good that we're all here. This is really such an honor, and we all should share in this because, first of all, it was CCB that was the force behind accessible pedestrian signals, and it's basically those of us as consumers who are the force behind most things that go on. So thank you very much.
Well, I think I told the truth when I said I wanted a friend in the house, and we've been friends for quite a while. She may be executive director at the Lighthouse, but when we ran around at these blind advisory committee meetings of one kind or another and all those things, she never was too busy or too whatever to help me when I got stuck with my chair or couldn't find what I needed to find. She was there. She just helps individuals, and you know, every executive director doesn't do that. Okay, now, I'm glad my committee is here because I'm needing them, and I want to move along because I want to get to our speaker, but I do have a couple of things more to do. We have a Hall of Fame in the California Council of the Blind. We established it back in 1996, and we have many people in there. This year we voted for four, but two of them are not here. They're in Los Angeles, in that area, down south. So if you're here, you know it's not you, but you want to be sure and be there in the fall because you want to have you be there when they get theirs. You'll be proud of that. But we are giving two of them, and they are here. And I have the pleasure, and I wanted Al Gill to do these because he's a Hall of Famer, as am I. But anyway, I'm going to do this, and I wanted Al to do it because it's, you know, when you really know people and you really are fond of them, it's hard to do this and keep yourself all together. But I'm going to try this. The first gentleman, and it is the gentleman that's going in the Hall of Fame, worked for many years as a counselor for the Department of Rehabilitation. He worked during the day to help his people. From time to time, he received a little fuss from the department because he always wanted his clients to have the best and right now, if possible. He had two languages that he spoke, so he was able to help people that others couldn't. He was particularly helpful to deafblind people. He took his commitment seriously. If he's ever a friend of yours, you have a friend. He can tell you the date he served the people, what year it was, even though he was there for 35 years. He knows all of these things. He believes in commitment. He did his job well. He was married for 44 years, and now he's going to know who he was, I think. But in any case, he is a friend to everyone, and he tells stories, and he almost is as bad with them as Al Gill, but But even so, we're going to put into the Hall of Fame a man that has been faithful to this council for years and years and deserves it, and it's our friend Elmer Chapson.
Again, California Council of the Blind Hall of Fame, Elmer Chapson, a counselor for the California Department of Rehabilitation for 35 years, specializing in work with blind people with additional disabilities in Spanish as well as English, always sensitive to the needs of those he served for decades, active in the council and its chapters and affiliates in many leadership capacities. For Elmer.
Congratulations.
Kathy and fellow members, this is probably one of the most meaningful moments in my whole life, and I wish to thank you one and all.
See, he didn't say that I asked him six times if he was coming to the banquet. And that we needed him here because he adds so much to everything. And that wasn't a story. He really does. Our second person to be entered into the Hall of Fame is a person who has been with the council as long as anyone I know. And when I say I'm thinking of starting an octogenarian affiliate, I'm not kidding. There are a lot of us up here. And we still are going strong and doing what we need to do. This man was working very hard through the years. He was instrumental in starting the Alameda County chapter. He was instrumental in establishing the East Bay Center for the Blind. He single-handedly held one chapter together for a long time. He has been a faithful advocate, and I bet one time we did a thing where you stood up according to the years you joined the council. Well, nobody I think is here that will stand up longer than this gentleman. When I say what year he joined, he'll know that I did a little talking to him too. He joined this council in 1938. And ladies and gentlemen, I believe he is here. It's my pleasure to put a very deserving member into the Hall of Fame on behalf of our committee, Frank Silva.
California Council of the Blind Hall of Fame, Frank Silva, a loyal and dedicated member of the council for decades and an ardent advocate for blind and visually impaired people of California, serving as a founding leader of the Alameda County Club of the Blind and the East Bay Center for the Blind. Frank Silva.
Well, I guess this proves one thing. If you hang around long enough, you'll win something. Well, I want to thank everybody here and everybody what is involved. It took a lot of pressure from Kathy, I think, to put this across, but I appreciate it, and I have worked in the chapter since 1938. It's a long time, but I think it was worth it. Thank you.
Just think, next year will be 70 years. We ought to have some kind of a wingding for that, Frank. All right, we're going to do the final award. And I'm happy to be doing this one. When we have people who work with us, for us, in our behalf, we often find very special people. We found one when we hired a young lady who came to work for us. Well, let's see, not too young. She has three sons and a daughter. She's going to know who she is. But then a lot of people may have three sons and a daughter. One of them's an engineer, one's a pilot, one's waiting for his bar exam to come through, and the daughter is in special ed. Now she knows who she is. In any case, she has worked for us for some time, and with the move, she and I are going to stay at home in Hayward while the others move on. And she, we thought about giving her the plaque in the awards committee, but before we got everything finalized, it came from the heads of this organization, and it came down to us, and what's in it is very serious, and I mean, what it's meaning, we mean it. We love her a lot, and Marilyn Kohler, we wanted you to, we know you're not going to forget us, because I'm going to be down there, and hey, we're now buggy all the time, but anyway, and she said yesterday that she would help me no matter what we were doing, so she's been a godsend to us, and the Ellen Murphy Fund, she does all of the application intakes and reads them and sends them on to the other trustees and passes on the checks where they have to go. And she's very helpful to us, as well as mailing the Blind Californian and listening to all of us when we call in with our various woes. And so, Marilyn, we're going to give you, and we're not sure what to call it, award, a kind of award, but it's, I think it's a We Love You award.
Actually, the way it reads is that it's the California Council of the Blind Special Award to Marilyn Kohler, a truly outstanding employee beloved for her compassion and dedication. Congratulations, Marilyn.
Oh, I have no words. Thank you so much, and I can't tell you how much this job has meant to me and each and every one of you, and I love you all, and I will stay in touch, and please stay in touch with me. I love you all. Thank you.
We're doing fundraising around here, Marilyn. No tears. We're going to just start charging for every drop of water. Yeah. Okay, now we have had a good evening. I hope you've enjoyed. How do you like the award selection? You think they're okay? Yeah! Well, I have an announcement to make the awards committee wanted me to make. You all need to take the time to think about who deserves them. Write them up. Some of them we've been coming up with, and the award people say you all ought to come in and write them up. Please do, because we're going to want written something. If you think someone is worthwhile, you should give us a little letter, and it should be a short one, but you should write something up so that we make sure we do the right thing by your nominees. Now, something I've been looking forward to for a very long, long time is hearing from our speaker. I've talked to people who've heard him, and they say that he's very good. And I've been sitting here visiting with him, and he knows all kinds of things, like when I should say I and I should say me, but he didn't make any headway. I say it backwards anyway. Anyway, this gentleman was on 9/11 in the Twin Towers when somebody decided to destroy them. And God bless us all and him too. He's still here. He was saved, and he was one of the lucky ones. And he escaped from the center with his dog, Roselle. And he's going to tell us about that. But his wife is in the hotel, but not with him. She recently lost her father just 2 weeks ago. And she's having the quiet time that we know that people need when we lose our parents or any of our loved ones. But I know that he will tell his wife how much our thoughts and prayers are with her. Mike has had a guide dog, has used a guide dog for 40 years. And he's had a lifelong partnership with guide dogs, and it works for in the people they serve.
Prior to becoming the National Public Affairs Representative for Guide Dogs for the Blind, Michael was District Sales Manager for Quantum Data Protection Division of Irvine, California, overseeing a sales force and field operations. He has a master's degree in physics from the University of California at Irvine. He's a former member of the California State Guide Dog Board and is a member of the National Federation of Blind. Michael lives with his wife in Northern California, and I am so looking forward to him, and I apologize to you for being so late, but holding you up so late. But, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Michael Hinkson.
Wow, what an introduction. Thank you very much, Kathy. I recall last year being introduced by a lawyer who kept his hands in his pockets. And this lawyer came up to the podium and he said, I want to introduce to you Michael Hinkson and Roselle, two very rare creatures indeed. Wow. Was that profound and deep? I didn't know what to say to that, so all I could say when I got to the podium was, I thought that we had a much rarer creature in our midst, and that was a lawyer who kept his hands in his own pockets. What a world, huh? Well, it's a real pleasure to be here, to be able to talk with you this evening. Leo Tolstoy once said that the only problem with Christianity is that no one really practices it. I could make that same comment probably about other religions, especially in the light of events over the past 6 years, but we're not going to get into a religious discussion tonight. I'd rather change that slightly and talk about the concept of diversity. And again say, the only problem is no one really practices it. This week in the news, we heard about Don Imus.
Yes.
Now, Don Imus got his start on KUTY in Palmdale, where I grew up, but, you know, we forgive him. But Don Imus made some very reprehensible remarks, and they caused a hue and cry, especially in certain quarters of the so-called diverse community. And I've heard parts of the segments of the Al Sharpton radio program. I've heard some of the comments of Jesse Jackson, how they took him to task, demanded that he be fired. And they got their way. On Thursday evening, CBS fired Don Imus from his radio program. There are certainly a lot of different thoughts as to whether the I-man should have been fired or not, and I won't go into them, although I think that he certainly deserved to have something done for making such inappropriate remarks. But I ask you the following question. Where were those same professionals, experts in diversity, people who claim that all are equal, when this year, last year, and over the past several years, blind people in Minnesota were not able to get taxi rides? Where were those same diversity people earlier this year when a young deaf boy who wanted to take his service dog to school in New York in Al Sharpton's backyard was denied? Where were those same diversity people a few years ago when a new Democratic headquarters was built in Marin County but was wheelchair inaccessible? The number of examples go on and on and on. The reality is, diversity is what we each, for some reason, choose to make of it, rather than all joining together and recognizing that diversity can be a strong thing and that differences, the differences we all have, are what make this country the great country that it is. Yeah. We who are blind are fighting the battle to say it is okay to be blind, and it is not okay to discriminate against us simply because we are not. The fact of the matter is that we are all part of the same society, and as a result, we have the same prejudices. There are so many of us who have our own unique focuses, or foci, to be grammatically correct so that Kathy doesn't shoot me. Gotta keep up with physics. It's foci, you know. We all need to and do focus on our own part of the world. But the world is becoming a smaller place every day. And the fact of the matter is, we can no longer afford to ignore the precepts of Islam, which teach the same peace and love that Christianity preaches, that Judaism teaches, that so many religions teach. We need to become more versed in the teachings of others and need to find areas of common ground rather than differences. Diversity needs to lead to unity. It has to be that way, or we'll never be successful in our lives and in our goals in this world. It is all around us, love and peace. There are so many examples of trust. We trust that this microphone will work for the rest of the evening. We trust that the roof will stay over our heads. Trust is all around us, and that is as it should be. However, when we go into a place of work and we become part of a team, we immediately mistrust, because we have been taught in our lives that everyone really needs to look out for themselves and not for the other individual. I reject that, although it is all too common in our society today. True leaders, true team-oriented people know that trust and teamwork go together, and that, in fact, if you will, diversity is part of what makes any team strong. One of the great features of learning to use a guide dog is that we learn how to build a team. If we truly work with our guides properly, if we truly study and understand the techniques that the trainers teach, what we find is that that first month of bonding with our dogs and the next 11 or 12 months are the times that the team really forms. And is that really any different than what happens on the job or when we meet someone new and think about getting married? It's all about forming teams. It's forming one group, one unified goal for that group, whatever it may be. There can be diversity. There can be argumentation in the group. There can be conflict. There can be downright battles within the group. But once a decision is made, the decision is upheld by at least the majority of the team. If the team is truly a team, everyone abides by the decision. And that's true with a guide dog as well. Example. Come to the street corner. Walking along a sidewalk, as we do on a regular basis, I come to a street corner. I listen to see which way the traffic is going, in theory. So we're going to use a simple street corner. We're not going to get into those 5 and 6 intersection things where audible traffic signals are a beautiful thing. We're going to deal with the straight 4-corner intersection. I go to the corner, and I listen to the way the traffic is going. I hear the traffic going the same way I want to walk. Now, you know, my master's degree in physics is a handy little thing to have, because I learned that two pieces of matter cannot occupy the same space at the same time. That's something that they teach us. The thing that they don't really tell you, though, is that if two pieces of matter do end up trying to occupy the same space at the same time, the bigger piece wins. So in reality, I wait for the traffic to go the way I want to go. and then I cross the street. So I step down off the curb, take a step, and suddenly my guide dog decides, for whatever reason, we can't cross. Do I question the dog? Do we stand there and have a debate? Or do we do what the dog says and then go back and discuss it later? Well, I do tell you that we do what the dog wants to do and then discuss it later, because her job as a member of the team is to make the decision as to whether we can continue across or not. I give the command forward, then I give control of the situation to her, not to decide whether she wants to go left and I want to go straight ahead, but as we walk straight ahead, whether it's safe. And if she backs up, if she swerves, I'm going to follow her because I trust her. And she knows I trust her. That is the part of the team relationship that is really profound, that each member of the team understands the trust. Each member, although totally different in thought processes, although totally different in physical makeup, although totally different in the way we communicate, in other words, although totally two diverse creatures, we work together for a common goal. And that is as it should be. That is something that we do not find as often as we really should in our society today. I have been using guide dogs, as Kathy said, for quite a while. Actually, it's now been almost 43 years. I got my first guide dog in 1964. I will not debate which is better, a guide dog or a cane, because they're different. And I also believe that the cane, being the most basic tool, is something that people should learn before they can make an intelligent choice about whether or not to use a guide dog. And just learning to use a cane doesn't really give you the information to make that choice, but it gives you the information that allows you to ask the questions to make the choice. For me, a guide dog is a wonderful addition to my life. It is a lifestyle choice that I made some time ago. And I will tell you that over the past day, it has been borne out in ways that I can't possibly really describe, but I'm going to try. Yesterday, we were in Knoxville, Tennessee to do a speech, and we had to go through the security, go into the airport last night to fly home. We got to the airport only to learn that the flights were canceled. So I then sat in Knoxville waiting and waiting. What do? I've got to get home. I had a graduation at Guide Dogs today because my fifth guide dog, Roselle, recently retired, and I was graduating with my sixth dog, Merrill. Merrill and I did in-home training, so that's why she was out traveling. So we eventually got on a plane to Dallas at 10 o'clock at night, Knoxville time, getting into Dallas at about 9 o'clock, and actually getting in a little after 11, about 11:20. To find that there were no flights to San Francisco, and the airlines were doing nothing to make sure that people had some sort of an accommodation for the night. Merrill and I sat all night at a gate, and I slept and she slept, but before we did, it was great having Merrill because I had someone to talk to discuss the virtues. To discuss the virtues of airport personnel and world-class airline service. Because Merrill was new, she listened with rapt attention to every word I had to say. And I know we'll take it into account in the future when we travel, which will happen again next week. We finally made it back to San Francisco this morning at 9:30, went off to meet Merrill's puppy raisers, had our graduation, and I was able to make it here this evening. So it's been a long day, but I got my 6 hours of sleep at the airport, so I'm good. In any case, having used a guide dog for so long, I've learned about these team concepts. I didn't really learn to articulate them as much as I do today until after 9/11, in reality. I learned that, in fact, teamwork was something that I've been teaching to my sales forces when I worked for Quantum Corporation as the regional sales manager. It's been something that I've used on a regular basis. Teamwork is what saved my life on 9/11. Let me tell you a little bit about the story of 9/11. I was asked to do that. I know some of you have probably heard it. I hope that it won't be too boring, but we'll try. We'll try to make it a little different as we go. My job on September 11th was working as the regional sales manager for Quantum Corporation. So that meant I hired the sales force. I fired the sales force when they didn't do their jobs. I taught them that their main goal in life was to support their manager in the manner that he wished to become accustomed to. And I taught them how to work as a team and to view their manager as a second member of their team, that they had strengths and weaknesses, and I had some things to contribute to every potential sale that we had with the company. What they learned very quickly was that I had a greater technical grasp of the product than they did. I'm not bragging about that, but rather saying to you, I had that knowledge because I worked to get it. It was a knowledge that all of them should have. And every time we would go on a sales call and we would leave and they would say, how did you know this or that about the product? I'd say, gee, didn't you read the product bulletin last week? Dead silence. After a while, I did a fairly decent job of shaming them into becoming much more technically sophisticated about the products. But one of the things that I offered as a member of their individual sales teams was the ability to come and help them in dealing with some of the technical aspects. And it wasn't really so much the technical knowledge. It was learning to know when to use any given piece of information, which was another way of saying that as part of sales, it was knowing how to listen and to recognize that the better salespeople cannot ever sell you anything, no matter what it is and when it is. You have to want to buy it, and their job is to really decide and help you decide whether they have the right product for you. The really good salespeople will also tell you whether or not their product works for you and won't just try to sell it to you just because. How often do you see that in sales, especially in a diverse sales environment? In any case, on September 11th, we were in our office on the 78th floor of Tower 1 of the World Trade Center. You know how high 78 floors are? It's over 1,000 feet in the air. It was so high that on the 4th of July, people would go to our offices to look down on the fireworks displays in New York City. The elevator that went to our floor, that went directly to our floor, traveled at 22 miles an hour and took 48 seconds to go from floor 1 to floor 78. It was an amazing feat of architecture, the World Trade Center. And on September 11th, my staff was out because they were supposed to be selling the way their manager needed them to in order to become more acclimatized to the lifestyle that he really wanted, if you know what I'm saying. We were training some of our reseller partners, so they didn't need to be there, our staff didn't, because they knew this stuff already, or were supposed to. So there were several of us in the office. None of the people who were there other than Roselle and I were residents of the office. There was one other Quantum person there, and that was David Frank. David was a colleague from our California office who was there because he had account responsibility for some of the people who were there that day. At 8:45, we were just finishing final preparations for the seminars, doing some final security work for the people downstairs. Most of our guests were in the office in our conference room waiting for us to come in, waiting for some others to arrive. The PowerPoint projector was all set up. Anybody here know what PowerPoint is? Blind people can do that sort of stuff, you know. Drives people to distraction when a blind guy comes in with a laptop projector and sets it up and says, let's do this here PowerPoint presentation. By the way, let me tell you, if you want to do something and be successful as a blind person, learn how to sell, because sighted people don't know how to deal with you, and you can, if you ask a lot of questions, can learn a whole lot more, because they don't know how to say no or say, I'm not going to talk to you. They're too afraid to do it. You can get the sale before they know what happened to them. So I'm telling you, get out there, take a Dale Carnegie sales course, and learn to sell. It really works. So everything was prepared The last thing we had to do was to get a list of people who were going to be attending the seminars for the World Trade Center security people. We were just about to complete that task when suddenly we heard a muffled explosion, David and I did, and the building gave a shudder and then began to move. Now, I know most of y'all here know what it feels like to be in an earthquake. Anybody here never been in an earthquake?
Yeah.
No, no, no. Anybody here never been in an earthquake? Some of you. Okay, well, stay around after the rest of us leave. We'll set it up for you. It didn't feel like that, though, because instead of moving side to side, the building kept moving in one direction. It just kept tipping and tipping and tipping. Moving in one direction, kept going. David and I said, "What is this?" And I said, "I don't know." And David said, "I don't know what this is. I do know that the building was moving. I grew up in Palmdale, California. Don't care whether it was an earthquake or not. Went to the doorway, you know. 78 floors up, it was going to make a big difference. Went to the doorway anyway. And I stood there, and the building kept moving. We moved about 20 feet. And before the building stopped, David and I said goodbye to each other because we thought we were going to fall to the street. And then the building stopped. And it began to move back the way it had come. Eventually, it got to a vertical position, and I walked back into the office, and I met Roselle coming out from under the desk. Now, Roselle's job, once we got to the office, was to greet everybody who came in because she figured they all came to see her anyway. And then after she did that, she went under the desk and went to sleep till the next crowd came. You know, that was her job. But on this morning, I met her coming out from under the desk. I took her leash, told her to heal, which meant to come and sit on my left side, which she did. And she just sat there, kind of yawning, wagging her tail like nothing was going on. David, meanwhile, released his hold on my desk because he was not in a doorway. He was from the Bronx. He didn't know what to do in an earthquake. David turned and looked out the window and said, "Mike, oh my God, there's fire and smoke above us. We got to get out of here right now." And I said, "Well, slow down, David." "No, no, no. You don't understand. There's fire and smoke above us." I said, "I understand, David." "No, you don't. You can't see it." The line. You can't see it. I could hear debris falling outside the window. David saw it. No question that there was something going on out there. The building doesn't move 20 feet for nothing. I said, "David, slow down." I finally got him to focus. Because you see, I had a piece of information that he wasn't observing. Our guests began to scream. They started moving from our conference room toward our exit, which was near my office. But I got David finally to focus because I used a piece of information that none of them, well, the other people wouldn't have seen, but David didn't observe. David, again, my colleague from California. David didn't notice that my dog wasn't moving a bit. If she had sensed any kind of danger, do you think she would have just sat there? She'd have been yanking me to the doorway like nobody's business. That's the teamwork and trust. That is the relationship that told me that something was going on, but it wasn't so serious at that instantaneous point in time that we couldn't evacuate according to procedure. Now, as the manager of that office, I took responsibility sometime before to learn what to do in the case of an emergency. I had to be able to lead the team, to lead who was ever in the building. I knew what to do if we had an emergency. I had to participate in all of the fire drills. That was my responsibility. And folks, no matter what job you have, no matter what you do, you need to take responsibility for your actions and for making sure that you can be safe in any kind of an environment. And also make sure that you know what to do because you might have to be the one to help others. You cannot rely on someone to necessarily be expected to do it for you. We must take responsibility for living our lives. I am very fond of traveling around this world, and I've spoken in various places, including the Korean Human Rights Commission. I've spoken in Japan and Ireland, New Zealand. I've even spoken in Alabama. There's a foreign country for you. No, I like Alabama. I loved being in Alabama last year. It was the first time I was ever there, and I had several opportunities to speak. Wonderful people down there, and it was a lot of fun. But the point is that I, in speaking in all of those places, try to get people to understand blindness isn't the handicap I face, that the real handicap are the attitudes and misconceptions that people have about blindness. The barriers that people impose are the real issues. You really think that's something? You ought to be with my wife and I when we go into a restaurant. She uses a wheelchair, right? So it's great. She's short. I don't make eye contact. She's clearly different shape. She's in this wheelchair. We go into a restaurant, go up to the hostess or host station, stand there. Many times they'll look at us. They'll look from her to me and me to her. And Karen finally says, they're looking back and forth between us, Mike. They don't know who to talk to. So when we play that little game, I finally say, well, let me help you out. I may be blind, but I can hear. She may be in a wheelchair, but she can hear. You know, she could probably even read your lips if you don't speak well, but we'll work that out. But what you ought to do is to treat us like anyone else. And we kind of get through that. My favorite thing is you go into a restaurant, any of us who are blind, we go into a restaurant, we sit down at the table, and the first thing the waitress says is, do you want me to tell you about what's on the menu? And I say yes, and then what do they say? What do you want? I thought you were going to tell me about the menu, but you know, whatever. And so we have this challenge. But I believe that we need to take responsibility and recognize that just because we're blind, it doesn't mean that we can't do things. We may use alternatives. Sighted people use alternative techniques. I know some of you have heard me talk about this before. Sighted people are loaded with alternative techniques because sight isn't all it's cracked up to be anyway. I mean, let's look at it. Back in the good old cave era, anybody ever remember being cave people? Jenny, any of you done that? You know, until they had fire, they were really lost when they went into caves, right? And then they got this thing called fire, and they finally figured out how to kind of have it last a while so that they could walk around the cave. But, you know, all that was a reasonable accommodation so that sighted people could function in the dark. And then Thomas Edison came along, and he kind of made a longer-lasting sort of bulb. He took fire and put it inside this little glass thing called the incandescent light bulb. And all it is, under the ADA, is just a reasonable accommodation for the sighted. But nobody makes a big deal about that. They make a big deal if I use a dog or a KNFB reader or a Braille note or anything like that. And some people say they're awfully expensive. I don't know. With the money people spend on light bulbs and some of the costs that you can pay for a light bulb today, I'm not sure that it's such a bad deal. And, you know, back in 2000, when we had all those brownouts out here, blind people are what saved California because we didn't turn the lights on to read, right? Yet I don't see any of those diversity people giving us rewards or awards for that. They just keep using electricity to go on the radio. Well, anyway, the fact of the matter is we all use reasonable accommodations. We all use technology of one sort or another. But it still goes back down to we must all use our wits and our brains and our knowledge and take responsibility for what we do. And that's what I did some time ago when I learned how to move around the World Trade Center. I worked at getting lost in the World Trade Center so that I could figure out how to get back where I wanted to go because I needed to know how to get from place to place. I did all that I could to learn how to function in the case of an emergency because I never knew if I was going to be in the office alone, and I never knew whether or not I might have to help somebody else get out. And there we were on September 11th, 2001. People were panicking because there was all this fire that they could see through our window to the outside, and I was telling people to slow down, got people to focus, and finally got David Frank to get our other guests to the stairs and starting them down. Then I called my wife to tell her that we were leaving and that because something had happened, there had been an explosion or something, that we were evacuating. This was like 8:47, long before the media got the story. And then I had to hang up the phone. David was back. We did a couple final things, and we left and went to the stairs and started down. Now, The media picked up my story after 9/11, and they said how miraculous it was that this blind man was led out of the World Trade Center by his guide dog. You know, I don't know about you, but if you're walking downstairs, is it really that hard to get lost? My guide dog, however, was invaluable going down the stairs because she gave me something to focus on so I would not worry about all the things that were going on or that could be going on. We, as we began our descent, smelled an odor, and it took me a couple of floors to realize I was smelling the fumes from burning jet fuel. I have traveled a lot at airports. I knew the smell. When I finally realized what it was, I made the observation to other people because, you see, none of us knew what had happened. The plane actually hit on the 96th floor on the other side of the building from us. People said to me afterward a lot, well, of course, you didn't know what happened. You couldn't see. And I'm sitting there going, let me help you out here. The airplane hit on the north side of the building. I was on the south side of the building. I was on the 78th floor. It was on the 96th floor. How was I supposed to know what happened? Do you have X-ray vision that I don't know about? None of us knew. There were others on the stairs. We had no clue as to what had happened. So we went down the stairs, assuming that a plane hit the building because of the fumes that we smelled. I focused on working with Roselle. I kept praising her, telling her she was doing a good job, and likewise, because she was guiding and doing what I expected of her, we, in a circular sort of way, helped each other. We're able to focus on what we needed to be able to get out. That, by the way, helped any number of other people who saw that we were going down the stairs and told me later, we decided that if you could go down those stairs, certainly we could go. If that dog could go down the stairs, I can go down the stairs. And that's as it should be. So as we went down the stairs, there were a couple of times that burn victims passed us on the stairs. There was a woman who stopped near us and said, I can't go on, I can't breathe. And we all stopped and had a group hug. We just all just held each other and said, look, we're in this together, let's keep going. And she was able to continue down the stairs. David at one point said, Mike, we're not going to make it out of here. And I said, stop it, David. And he told me later that snapping at him brought him out of his funk. He did a very interesting thing, something that I would never have thought of. And I don't know whether he thought of it volitionally or it just was a reaction to everything that went on. But David left me and walked a floor down below us. And then he stayed a floor ahead and announced to everyone above him, including me, and I think he did it originally for my benefit, but so many others were able to take advantage of it. He told us what floor he was on and anything that he saw on the stairs. He became an advanced scout for people 10, 15, 20 floors above who could hear his voice. So he kept going down the stairs, floor 40, 39, 38. He kept going down. We followed. We all talked, tried to figure out what was going on. Eventually, he got to the 30th floor, and he said, I see firemen coming up the stairs. Everybody move to the side of the stairwell. Well, the stairwell was over 4 feet wide. There was plenty of room to step to the side and let other people pass on the stairs. I went down the stairs to where he was, and I said, tell me what you're seeing. He said, I see firemen. They're all dressed in the heavy protective clothing that firemen need to wear to keep themselves safe. And all they're doing is coming up the stairs, carrying all the equipment that they need to fight the fire, oxygen cylinders, fire axes, all sorts of things. And here they come. And they came, and then they stopped. They stopped where we were, and they said, hey, buddy, can we help you get down the stairs? And I said, no, we're okay. And they said, no, well, we really want to make sure that you get down the stairs. We want to help you. And I said, no, there's really not a problem. I've got my guide dog, Roselle, here. We're in good shape. And they started petting Roselle. You know, it wasn't the time to give them a lecture about don't pet the guide dog. Besides, she was eating it up. You know, what do you do? And they said, look, we really want to make sure you get down the stairs. We're going to send somebody with you. You know, it wasn't the time to give them the lecture either about blindness isn't the handicap. So instead, I did something that was the only thing that they would really understand, because I wanted them to go out and fight that fire. I don't want them helping me out. I don't want to get burned out on the stairs, you know. So I just said, look, I'm okay. I've got a friend here who can see, and David and I are going down the stairs. We're in good shape. It was what they understood. It was what made them feel comfortable. And so they were able to continue to go up the stairs after giving Roselle some final pats. The last unconditional love they ever got. So they went up the stairs and we continued down. And eventually, David, having reassumed his position ahead of us by a floor, he announced that he had gotten to the first floor and said that there was a water curtain. All the sprinklers were on, making this curtain of water between us and the lobby. And then he was gone. We got to the first floor. I could hear this water coming down, this incredible torrent. It literally sounded just like a waterfall. We burst through that water, Roselle and I, and found ourselves now in the lobby of One World Trade Center, which was normally just an office building, but that day it was just this chaotic scene. Water was ankle deep on the floor. Every step you took, you could feel something breaking under your feet because the tiles had fallen from the roofs or some of the marble had fallen and so on. And people were yelling, "Go this way, over here!" And they were rushing us not outside, but rather into the central part of the World Trade Center. The first floor of the World Trade Center, let's all go back and look at what the World Trade Center really is. The World Trade Center was really a group of buildings that surrounded a common central area. The first floor of the common central area was a shopping mall. Just like any shopping mall, it had all the usual stores. It had a photo store, a 24-hour passport photo store. It had a Radio Shack. It had a Borders Books. It had a Hallmark store, and then it had kind of more important stores, things that you really needed to have in a center like the World Trade Center. You know, Godiva chocolates, Krispy Kreme, you know, the important things. Actually, Krispy Kreme was outside, but they had a cart. So normally that place is full of thousands of people at 9:35 in the morning, but that day, because of the evacuations, it was empty, and you could hear your footfalls as you ran through that shopping arcade, that shopping mall. Finally, we were ushered up an escalator and out a door at the far end of the Trade Center, as far from the Twin Towers as we could be. No one told us what was going on. We got outside, and once we were outside, David started looking around, and he said, "Hey, Mike, I think I see fire in the second tower." Remember, we didn't know. And I said, "David, what do you mean?" He says, "I think I see fire in the second tower. It's on fire." I said, "How can that be?" We had no clue. The only thing that we could think of is because our building had moved and leaned toward the other tower, that maybe the fire had jumped from our building to the other tower, because we never felt the second plane hitting. And so we decided what we needed to do, because we were told to leave the World Trade Center, and we decided that what we had to do was to go to a car that David had parked in a parking lot, which happened to be right across from Tower 2, across the street. So we did what we were told. We left the World Trade Center, we crossed the street, and then we just sort of circled back around to get to this car. We were one block away when David stopped and he said, "I want to take some pictures before we get to the car." I said, "Okay." And I wanted to try to call my wife Karen again, who was at our home in Westfield, New Jersey. I took out my phone. I tried to call her. I was not able to get through. David was taking pictures with his camera. He put the camera away eventually, and then he... I put my phone away, and then he was just putting his camera away when suddenly a police officer yelled, "Get out of here right now, it's coming down." We heard this kind of rumble, and literally about a half a second later, it was this deafening roar. The only way I can describe the sound, it was kind of a combination between a freight train coming at you and a waterfall. You could hear glass breaking, metal ripping apart, things beginning to fall. Everyone turned and just ran in different directions. No one was helping anyone. There was no teamwork at all, except for Roselle and me. David was long gone. I turned 180 degrees from the way I was facing and ran back the way I came on Broadway, headed toward Fulton Street. There was a building on my right-hand side, and I stayed very close to the building because I could tell that there was a little bit of an overhang above my head. We kept running. And I remember, just as soon as I started to run, that I said, "God, I can't believe that you got us out of a building just to have it fall on us." And I then heard in my head, as clearly as you hear me, you can decide what you make of this. I know my choice. But I heard a voice in my head that said, "Don't worry about what you can't control. Focus on running with Roselle and what you can control, and the rest will take care of itself." What a life lesson. Don't worry about what you can't control. I could make the same comment about being blind. We are blind. And unless you've got some way to fix that for any one of you, railing about it, calling God into question about it, or any of those kinds of things is not going to help you a single solitary bit. Don't worry about what you can. Focus on the things you can. You can make yourself a better person if you choose. We all can do that. We all can improve our lives if we choose to do so. Focus on the things over which you have control. I got it, this sense of peace, this sense that if Roselle and I worked together and did function as a team, we would be okay. We continued to run. We got to the corner of Fulton and Broadway. I took a right-hand turn on Fulton, caught up with David. To be perfectly fair, David had stopped because he realized that he had run and we were separated. But still, we caught up, and then the three of us began to run, and almost immediately we were engulfed in the dust cloud, the fine particles of the building that was just collapsing and breaking apart. Suddenly we were breathing in more dirt, debris, and dust and junk than we were breathing in air. Literally, we were drowning in it. You could feel it going down your throat. You could feel this every time you took a breath. We were literally choking on it. We had to get out of that air, that wretched air. We looked for an entrance to the building that we were next to. I kept telling Roselle, go right, right. I don't think she could hear me, but she saw the hand signals. I kept listening for an opening. Hey, there was a lot of noise. It would certainly have been real easy to hear anything that came along. And David, I think, was looking, but David said you couldn't see your hand 6 inches in front of your nose. We kept running. And finally, I heard this opening on my right, and Roselle must have saw it because she turned, ran one step, and then stopped dead. She stopped because we were at the top of a flight of stairs. She did her job perfectly. She did exactly what I would expect her to do. It was great. We went down the stairs, and as soon as I reached the bottom, I heard a woman near me crying, and she said, I can't see. My eyes are filled with dirt. Somebody help me. I don't want to fall into the subway, because we were in the arcade entrance to a subway station. I reached out, and I took her arm, and I said, hey, don't worry. I happen to be blind, but I got a guide dog, Roselle, here, and she will make sure that neither of us fall down the stairs. You are okay. How quickly teamwork reasserted itself, even in the most adverse environment possible, it was back to helping other people because we could. I asked this woman her name. She introduced herself as Carol. About that time, a guy came up from down below in the subway station. He introduced himself as Lou. There were about 9 of us. He said, come with me. I'll take you down to an employee's locker room in the subway system. And that's what we did. We followed him down. There was a locker room. There were some benches. There was a water fountain. There were a few other people there, retching and choking because of all the debris and dust. And there we stayed for about 15 minutes or so until a police officer came, found us, and said, you can go upstairs, the air is clear, get out of here right now. Didn't wait for an answer, he turned and walked away, and we all followed. We went up the stairs, we went through the shopping arcade, up the rest of the stairs to the street, and indeed the air was clear. David looked around and he said, oh my God, there's no Tower 2 anymore. I asked David what he saw, and he said, all I see is a pillar of smoke shooting hundreds of feet into the air. There's no Tower 2. I said, are you sure it's just not hidden by the smoke? And he said, Mike, it's not there. We stood, not understanding. We stood for a few minutes, and then we just turned and continued to walk down Fulton away from the World Trade Center complex. We walked about 15 minutes, and then we heard that freight train waterfall sound again. We knew it was our tower falling. We knew we were far enough away that we weren't going to be hit by debris. But David looked out, and he saw that there was a dust cloud coming, so we ran to get out of the way of the dust cloud. We were successful at avoiding it, and when the sound died away and the dust and the wind stopped, we opened our eyes, and David looked over, and he said, oh my God, there's no World Trade Center anymore. Again, we stood there not understanding, couldn't believe it. We couldn't understand and fathom what was happening to us. I called my wife Karen again. This time I got through, and she's the one who told us how two airplanes had been crashed deliberately into the towers of the World Trade Center, one into the Pentagon, and a fourth was still missing over Pennsylvania. That was the first time we knew that terrorists had attacked the United States because of a decision that some subhuman thug, some person who was clearly against anyone who was different than he or it, because I don't regard him as a human anymore, someone made that decision, and suddenly everyone's lives changed forever. 9/11 was a day that gave us the opportunity to make a choice. It was a choice that we were given to decide whether we were going to work more closely as one people throughout the world, or whether we were going to thrive by our differences, not recognizing that those very differences are what can make us all stronger. Different people have made different choices in that regard. We all have to decide what we are going to adopt as a new normal, because normal will never be the same again. It is something that... it is something that we face every day. We have to make decisions. Our normal is different than the normal of others. The normal that you and I face, the normal that people who have different skin colors faces, are different in some senses. But in some senses, they're all the same. To summarize it, though, I need to quote someone who I think is more in tune with the concept of diversity than most anyone who I have seen in most of our modern times. It is the person who I think, arguably, from all of our standpoints, could be considered the father of all organizations of blind people, and that's Dr. Jacobus Tenbroek, who formed the first organization nationwide of any blind people collectively in the United States, and who we've all in one way or another have modeled our lives after in terms of developing functional organizations. But I think that his greatest contributions are ones that are not recognized, and that is for providing some lessons on diversity that we all ought to take to heart. Let me quote one to you from the 1956 banquet speech that he gave we'll get to that. The remarks go something like this. In the 16th century, John Bradford made a famous remark which has ever since been held up to us as a model of Christian humility and correct charity, and which you have seen in some of the examples and illustrations that I have given you this evening. Seeing a beggar in his rags, creeping along a wall through the flash of lightning and a stormy night, Bradford said, "There, but for the grace of God, go I." Compassion was shown. Pity was shown. Charity was shown. Humility was shown. There was even an acknowledgement that the relative positions of the two could and might have been switched. Yet, despite the compassion, despite the pity, despite the charity, despite the humility, how insufferably arrogant, there was still an unbridgeable gulf between Bradford and the beggar. They were not one, but two. Whatever it might have been, Bradford thought himself Bradford and the beggar a beggar. One high, the other low. One wise, the other misguided. One strong, the other weak. One virtuous, the other depraved. We do not and cannot take the Bradford approach. It is not just that beggary is the badge of the past and is still all too often the present symbol of social attitudes toward us, although that is at least a part of it. But in the broader sense, we are that beggar, and he is each of us. We are made in the same image and out of the same ingredients. We have the same weaknesses and strengths, the same feelings, emotions, and drives. And we are the product of the same social, economic, and other environmental forces. How much more consonant with the facts of individual and social life, how much more a part of a true humanity to say instead, there within the grace of God, do go I. Those comments are what diversity and the true feeling of diversity and the true teachings of diversity are all about. We are and ought not to be two but one in common purpose, or three but rather one in common purpose. We create our own differences. We also can create our own similarities or our own ways to channel all of the differences that we have so that we can function more collectively together. Whereas Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, all of the so-called great leaders, when it comes to taking that kind of a stand? Where are our political candidates today when we talk about the true concept of diversity? How many of them have brought blind people into significant parts of their political campaign? How many of them talk about blindness and other kinds of disabilities as part of what they do? I don't hear it very often. Do you?
No!
That is intolerable, and until that changes, we cannot really say that people represent diversity well. We can take responsibility for calling people into question when they choose not to truly be representatives of diversity. The choice is yours. The choice is mine. The choice and our futures belong to all of us. Let's work together and make this truly the diverse and common world that we wish it to be. Thank you.
When something happens around Daryl and he really likes it, he'll say, "Well, I heard it all." And I think right then, we heard it all. You know, I think I have always said when something bad happens, that one door closes, another one opens. In our family, we had a serious tragedy. We lost one member of our family and almost Eric. And Eric wondered often why his brother wasn't here, and he was. And I said to him, he remained. I said, "Because I think the man upstairs has something special in mind for you." And he did. He has. He does wonderful work helping other people now. And you know, Mike, I think the same thing. I think when that someone spoke to you, they had something in mind for you. And I think the kind of message you're bringing may be it. And I certainly agree with you. Those people who find fault with everybody else ought to take a darn good look at themselves. I think that we really, really have enjoyed your speech, and we're so happy you made it out of that place.
Thank you.
You know, we have a few more things left to do, and that's going to be one heck of a hard act to follow. But we need your attention. We've got the drum and bell corps next door here. We're going to have some raffles. We have two raffles from the chapters. We have the guide dogs, a raffle, and we have the students raffle. And so that we don't show favorites, I'm going in alphabetical order. And we're going to start with the guide dogs. And so the guide dog representatives, please start coming forward, and students start coming forward too. And of course, last but not the very least, we've got a scholarship raffle we're going to do. That's where the $1,000 prize, the $500 prize, and the $300 prizes reside. But before we get there, we're going to do a 50-50. And Guide Dogs, have your representative up here yet?
We need ticket readers.
Right here.
Do we have
I am right here.
Oh, we have a person to read tickets. Okay.
We have a person to read tickets. Okay, what? Who is your person?
I'll read them. Who wants their ticket drawn? I'll do it.
What is your representative's name?
Huh?
Let Mike draw the ticket.
Where is it? Where is it?
I'm taking bids. Who wants their ticket drawn? Do I hear $20?
No, I want you to stay here and read my tickets.
Do I hear 50?
Make sure you have one ticket.
Yeah, one ticket.
They say I only can do one ticket. Well, the highest bidder.
Huh?
Not I. 638. Oh, wait. 3638. Oh, see? All right, you can bring me your money, too.
Guide Dogs.
Who was it?
In Mets.
Hey, Mets, see what I do for you?
Ken Metz is winning $90.
Now, if you want to donate that to Guide Dogs for the Blind, Ken, I'll...
Are the student tickets the ones that didn't have the Braille?
Oh, Lord.
Okay, I just want to know what I'm trying to read here. I've got some that don't have Braille. Who is the student representative? Congratulations, Ken.
Is he buying drinks later or what?
The question's been brought up, are you buying drinks later? Of course,
I don't hear him saying no.
He could say that he's buying the Guide Dogs lunch tomorrow.
Ooh.
Do we have a student on the way up for the drawing? Who's coming up? Is it
Haley?
Haley's coming.
Oh, a student's going to draw. There you go. An honest student.
Thank you, everybody, for supporting the students. We really appreciate it. We are low in our funding. I'm using teamwork. That's the key of this banquet, I think. I'm using teamwork to recount the money, but I got a count of $442.
Whoa.
So, applaud yourselves on that. This is 50-50, so students will only get half of that, but that's a heck of a lot better than what we had before. I was thinking maybe we get 100, so this is great. Artist Basin here is up here with me. Most of you know her. Who doesn't know her? I don't hear much of anything. Who does know her? Well, she took lots and lots of tickets from me and then came back and said, I need more. I've sold all those. And so, by golly gee, I think she raised the most money for us. And she's not even a student right now, but she's always been supportive of us. So I'm going to have her mix up her tickets and draw. And we'll get some more teamwork to help read it. She's mixing them and mixing them. You better hope she's mixing them well and not picking her own. She might cheat.
Well, they're not Braille.
They're not Braille, so she's stuck there.
The last four digits are 8553. 8553.
Oh, is there a name on the back?
I won that just like I do the lotto.
Close, but no cigar.
Hardly at all.
Anyone have 8553? Please raise your hand.
I'll raise my hand.
Yeah, I'll raise my hand.
If you have the ticket.
Put your little
no
paws down
ticket.
If you don't have it.
Well, there are a few people that said they couldn't find them. So they said they couldn't find them.
8553, are you here? If you're not here, say
they
so.
They are redrawing.
Okay, there you go.
The number is 8301. 8301.
Eric, do I have it?
That's Ken Metz again. I'm going to be suspicious.
Eric, do I have it? Eric.
People must be leaving.
Story of my life. I don't got it.
Actually, we're all here.
You always win something. I know you.
I never do. Never.
That's where you got so many tickets.
What is the do we have a winner?
Not yet.
No, they're redrawing.
8301.
Okay.
Mr. President, when we're through with this evening, can I go next door and give them the Beatitudes?
The new number drawn is 8373. 8373.
Who has it?
Leslie and Jeff.
Leslie. Okay, who verified that?
It's right here. It's a match. 8373. The winner is Leslie Tom.
Jeff and Leslie Tom.
Can we put these back in the bag? The other bag ones?
Jeff, in that case, you can go next door and give the Beatitudes after our meeting. Now I'm going to ask the president, the raffle time has come for the big prizes. And I wonder, Jeff, do you want to officiate on this?
No, I'll just take the prize. Forget
yeah,
the prize.
Yeah, that's what we want.
No, you already got your prize, Jeff. Just a minute, stir it. I'll put him. All right. Well, what shall we begin? Mr. President, what do we do first, the 300 or the 1,000? All right, we're drawing for the $300.
Oh, sure, that's what you said.
Just one.
I know, I'm making sure.
That's it.
Read the name.
Winner.
Yeah. So.
It says SVCV.
It says SVCB. The Silicon Valley chapter bought tickets and they won $300. We will now ask the American Council President to draw for the 500.
Oh, it just got drawn.
Oh, it got drawn already. All right.
Thank God.
Okay, I have it right here.
It's Beryl Brown.
Beryl Brown, are you here?
Huh? What is the prize?
That was $500. Now we're coming up to the Grand Prix. Let's have your attention, please. All right, we're ready for our $1,000 prize.
I think that's one.
Patricia L. Davis of San Diego.
Patricia L. Davis of San Diego. Let me say to those of you who haven't won our prizes tonight, think about this. When you lose this or lose the lotto, the law of averages is getting with you because you can be drawn once out of a million or whatever it is. And so every time you lose, it's coming your way. Now, we have a question that I have to have you all quiet so we can get the answer. Mr. President, are you going to wrap up or am I wrapping?
Kathy, you can wrap up.
I'm going to wrap up. Everybody grab your tablecloths. I don't have enough to wrap everybody up here.
It's a wrap.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you all so much. Come, I hope you've had fun. Thanks again to you all.